I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Before we start, I have to do a little clap to synchronize the audio. You know, that's not familiar.
I'm kind of straddling this chair.
I think you'll find it's jazz hands these days.
Oh, yeah.
Hello, hello, and welcome, or should I say, welcome back to the Indie Football Podcast. I am Ed Mallion. I am back from the Ryder Cup, where you may have seen that European victory sent the Americans home very salty indeed. No salt in this room, only two of my favourite people. To my left, may I introduce to you our man about London town. The man who just loves covering Arsenal more than life itself. It's Luke Brown.
Hi, you're right, Ed.
I am great. The Mourinho apologist on here, on a day when Mourinho needs apologists.
Someone's got to stand up for the man.
Someone's got to stand up for the downtrodden people in society, and Jose, of course, is one of those. To my right, a debutant, would you believe, it is ESPN's Chelsea correspondent. Liam, how do you pronounce your surname? I always get it wrong.
Toomey. Think Liam Chuckle Twomey. Brothers.
Liam Twomey is on the podcast.
Brother.
There was a kid in my school who had the same surname as you, but said it differently. So I'm not saying you've got it wrong, but maybe just rethink how you say it. But Liam, you were at Chelsea Liverpool.
I was.
At the weekend. When you saw former Chelsea striker Daniel Sturridge get the equaliser late on. I did catch that literally on someone's phone, like in a crap hotel just outside Paris. And everyone went crazy. There was a lot of people watching it there. It kind of felt like the big game of the weekend. So I think we should do a few minutes on that before we hit up the Champions League phone-in, which sounds exciting, and it's even better than you probably
imagine. We need a jingle for that.
Champions League phone-in. So yeah, Chelsea-Liverpool, talk to me, boys. I saw the denouement, if you will, and that incredible goal, and I think that's a good place to start, really.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, the game. It was probably the fastest game I've ever seen live. The first sort of...
Just the speed of play.
Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, Liverpool, we know, always press really high, really hard. Chelsea have been trying to do that since Sarri came in. And it was really impressive to see neither team compromise on the way they see how to play football. You know, Liverpool turned up high pressing. They actually ended up having more of the ball than Chelsea, which is the first time Chelsea have had less than 50% all season. Usually been comfortably over 60. And on the balance of chances, they probably should have won the game. And in the end, it took a moment of brilliance from Sturridge, who does love a goal against Chelsea.
He also loves a good goal.
Yeah.
I remember that one he scored in the Europa League final. Who do they lose to in the Europa League final?
Sevilla,
he scored a belting goal just before half-time. You know, he does occasionally come up in the big moments. He just doesn't get many moments full stop, I guess, in the Jurgen Klopp Liverpool team. They've got a lot of options there. I mean, they've still got players like Rian Brewster, who kind of we want to see get more time from...
Dominic Solanke,
like promising young England strikers. And you've got Sturridge there as well, Firmino and everyone. What do you think kind of that might do for him? Do you think there's a chance that he might get more in the picture now? Because... just purely from a kind of motivational and mental point of view, it's a big breakthrough for him, who's kind of been lost for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, he's a spectacular talent. He has been ever since he broke through at Manchester City. And the thing that's always held him back is his body. I mean, that's what makes me sceptical now that this could be part of some grand comeback, because it's just as likely that he comes on for Liverpool next week and gets a muscle injury. So it's difficult to say what happens, but I think actually this could be a really good role for him on this Liverpool team, maybe coming on with 15-20 minutes to go, not putting too much strain on the muscles, but whenever they need a moment of brilliance, we've seen many times that Sturridge is more equipped than most strikers to provide that.
I just hope he kind of does get that chance. I suppose the first point about Sturridge is that he's a kind of player that proves like the squad depth Liverpool have. And I know Shaqiri is not the best example to bring up because he missed that like great chance. But, you know, to be able to bring on players such as that, and they've got so many options in midfield as well. But, yeah, I remember writing or starting to write a profile about Sturridge last year, which never got published in the end. And
just deemed not good enough?
Just couldn't bother to finish it, to be honest. Oh, but, okay, like, I spoke to a couple of people. I spoke to a guy who, I can't remember who it was, but it was one of his teammates at, like, one of the, at City, like, right in the early days. And he said that, like, the quality he had was just like unbelievable. And he told me the story about how, like, in some youth team match, he scored a goal pretty much direct from kickoff. They kicked off, literally took the ball, rifled it in. And he's always kind of played like that. Like, he is quite a demanding player. He always wants the ball. You know, he doesn't track back. He doesn't work particularly hard.
He's a bit of a playground footballer.
Yeah.
Almost.
And somebody who's always been like the best.
Yeah. So, well, yeah. I mean, if he was that good as a kid, where you're essentially kind of like a globally elite player at 15 or whatever. Yeah, even the way that he joined City was incredibly, I mean, it was acrimonious, right? Mm. The way he left, he's bounced around a bit. I just think you forget that he was on loan at West Brom last year,
yeah.
Which was and when he signed for them, I thought, well, he's going to keep them up. But it just seemed like one of those signings, and then it was more like a signing Kostas Mitroglou than it was, you know, anything else. Like, they went down and he didn't really do anything, in the same way Fulham that did that season. So. What does this tell us about Liverpool, though, in terms of their ability to fight for a title? I mean, they've got their biggest test coming up this weekend with Liverpool against Manchester City.
I think it shows that they've got more weapons than ever before because, I mean, to a certain extent, in terms of process, plan A worked really well. They created a lot of chances against Chelsea, despite each half kind of had a slightly different pattern. I mean, Chelsea were playing quite high up. First half, second half, they were dropping a little bit more deep, but Liverpool managed to breach them either way. Salah could have scored a hat-trick. Shaqiri missed that gilt-edged chance. But then when all else fails, they do have that final option on the bench of Sturridge, who can just do something that no one would have thought possible. And they didn't have that last year or the last couple of years, partly because of Sturridge's injuries, but also because they didn't really have a bench until now. And I think that's a big weapon for Liverpool.
Also, players that were guaranteed starters for them before are now kind of bench options, which is probably better. Like Alberto Moreno off the bench, yeah, okay. Like, if he's starting left back for 38 games in the Premier League, you're in trouble. You know, the big thing with Fabinho, I guess, he's arrived for 40 million, he's barely played. And
well, Naby Keita has dropped out as well,
yeah,
last few games.
That's probably for the best, you know. Like, you're going to need a squad for the whole season. The thing, what they've done is we've talked about it a lot in the podcast, they forensically looked at the weaknesses in their team and then bought a player to replace that in the first team. But you still got guys that, you know, you can have Jordan Henderson on the bench, as he has been. You can have Milner on the bench. And there are a couple of players in that team who are irreplaceable. I think Virgil van Dijk seems the obvious one to me. He seems to be establishing himself as one of the better central defenders on the planet, I think, from what I've seen so far.
He totally swallowed up Olivier Giroud on Saturday. I've not seen Giroud be so ineffectual, even when he's not a goal threat, which is quite often. But even when he's not a goal threat, which turns out to be quite often, he's at least quite good at making the players around him better.
He's a great link man.
And every time they tried to hit the ball to him on the ground, on the floor, Van Dijk just completely owned him.
Mo Salah on his return to Stamford Bridge.
He looked a little bit tight to me. He looked like he was trying a little bit too hard. Maybe the game meant a little bit too much to him. But he got a couple of chances, particularly in the first 20 minutes, on his left foot, cutting in from the right. You know, textbook Salah chance. He balloons one way over the bar and miscues another. There was another one where he tried to play in Firmino when it would have been much more sensible to shoot. He was unlucky with the one that was cleared off the line. Brilliant recovery from Rudiger.
That team is, though, isn't it? That, like, Mohamed Salah can be going through this reasonably poor patch, and it's not even really
still
a story.
They're ticking off scores, you know, ticking off results. I mean, the winning run's gone, but it's still a good result for them. What's your current projection for Chelsea? Where do you see them at the end of the season now?
I predicted at the start of the season that they finished third, and as predictions often go, you immediately have second thoughts, but the results over the first few weeks have been much better than anyone expected, including Sarri. So I think they're ahead of schedule, and I'm more confident now that they'll finish third than I was. But I still don't see them in the same class as... I think City are still the class of the division, and there's a bit of a gap. Liverpool need everything to break right if they want to push them close.
We kind of said that it's kind of City, gap, Liverpool, bigger gap.
Mm.
And then there's a cluster of perhaps Chelsea, Spurs, Man United battling for two Champions League spots.
Yeah, I'm more confident now that Chelsea will finish top of that group.
Yeah, and Spurs, a lot of players ruled out for this game with Barcelona, and they play in the league next weekend. So, like, Eriksen's out, Ali's out, Lloris
returned to
is
training
back in
today.
Training. But, you know, they're missing a lot of guys. Serge Aurier, who we talked about at length last week, a lot of Spurs chat last week.
Serge special.
The power surge. That was... sorry, I just completely lost my track. Yeah, last week we did loads of Spurs, but they're in trouble. So I think
the gap between... like, obviously, this is recency bias, but it looks to me like the gap between Chelsea dipping down to Spurs and United is bigger than the gap between Chelsea and Liverpool. Because, I mean, Spurs have got some serious problems. United look like they're probably going to have a managerial change some point soon. And then you've got Arsenal, who are still kind of...
finding themselves.
Well, but, yeah, they look exceptionally brittle at the back. So I think that gap is actually going to be bigger than it has been in recent seasons.
And looking ahead to Liverpool, Manchester City, how do you see that going?
It's going to be an amazing game, isn't it? I mean, I think the great thing about Liverpool Chelsea was that it kind of suggested we're going to have this amazing title race, because the way City won the title last year, obviously you could have anticipated almost like a kind of slightly defensive reaction from other teams, and how did they actually counter City, how did they kind of work their way back into the title race. Liverpool and Chelsea just went at each other like from the first minute, and it was this kind of thrilling attacking game, and it looks like Liverpool are just going to fight fire with fire, basically. So yeah, it promises to be special. I mean, I don't know, you have to favour City, I suppose, but
I still do. I still think City are a superior side, but
haven't been playing exceptionally well,
you know,
have they?
And it's just, you know, these things don't even themselves out over a season. It's one-off games, isn't it? Could be a red card or something that completely flips these results. So,
and again, in a way that, you know, Salah's poor form isn't too much of a story for Liverpool, the fact that, like, De Bruyne has been out and yet City are still playing.
I kind of think, you know, if Liverpool win, it's a really interesting one for the title race.
Mm. Yeah,
because when, you know, City will get De Bruyne back and they all roar back into this, it's not a thing. But kind of if City have a bit to make up, there might be, you know, I think everyone wants a proper title race this year. You know, it's annoying not to have one.
Yeah,
you know, like, people that get bored of the kind of having to deal with, like, oh, there's a relegation battle, oh, who's going to finish seventh, that sort of stuff. Give us a proper title race, then we'll talk. Otherwise, we're not going to cover the Premier League on this podcast anymore, possibly. Champions League week, not for your boys, Liam.
No.
Big game against Vidi of Hungary coming up. Luke, you're covering Arsenal versus Karabag for us on Thursday.
But not in.
No, you're not going to Azerbaijan. We did have a journalist banned from there last year for writing about the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region.
Yeah, that ruined my preview.
which you can read on the website. Robert O'Connor wrote that. Just Google Nagorno-Karabakh, which I'm sure you all know how to spell. But, you know, one of the reasons the podcast was late, apart from me not being in the actual country, is that all the boys are out and about, obviously in different countries. Jack Pitt-Brook is in Germany. He's off there covering Hoffenheim versus Manchester City, which is the Tuesday night game. But then he returns in time for Spurs Barcelona at Wembley. So I'll get Jack on the phone and we can talk to him in a second.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Jack. We're doing a Champions League preview, as I did explain off air, and Spurs showed last year, really, that they can tough it out with the big teams at this level. We saw what they did with Real Madrid. Spurs-Barca at Wembley is a very enticing game, but what do we actually expect from them against Barcelona on Wednesday night?
Hi, Ed. My expectations for Tottenham on Wednesday night are not very high, to be honest. I know they've certainly turned a corner in recent games after that three-game losing streak. They've actually played okay in the second half against Inter. They lost those three losses. Then I thought they were a bit better when they won at Brighton, ground out the win against Watford, ground out the win at Huddersfield. So results have improved. Performances have slightly improved, but it's still not what you would describe as being classic Spurs. The big question, as ever, surrounds Harry Kane and his form. Again, like his team, I think he's slowly moving in the right direction. Scored one at Brighton, two at Huddersfield. Just about getting better shooting positions. But as with the rest of the team, it's not really the Kane of the last few years. I know they're playing against Barcelona, and that might make people pessimistic about the game, but then Barcelona are in a crisis of their own. Like I think they've dropped 6 or 7 points in the last three La Liga games, and so they will be coming in with no confidence either. So I think it could be a good game, but it's not going to be a classic.
And so if they are to win this game, what is the game plan do you think Pochettino is going to have to turn to? It's a team he's familiar with playing against, but you know, what strategy is he actually going to put out there?
It's interesting because before the game, Pochettino said that he wanted Spurs to play on the front foot and that was the best way to stop Barcelona. He said that Spurs had to try to have possession, to play in the Barcelona half, to push Messi as far away from their goal as possible, because they know that if Messi gets the ball near their goal, then it's going to be terrible, as he said. That said, if you look, I mean, my memory of the famous home wins against Borussia Dortmund and Real Madrid last year is that Spurs didn't really need to dominate possession. It was more a case of sitting back but using possession when they had it and attacking hard on the counter-attack. The way they cut through Dortmund and Real Madrid for those goals was really memorable. But the thing is, they did that when they had Dele Alli, who's obviously injured now at the moment, Heung-min Son in top form, he's only just come back from the Asia Cup. And that means that it's not really going to be, I don't know if Spurs can play that kind of fast counter-attacking style against Barcelona. I'm not really sure what sort of Spurs we're going to see on Wednesday night, to be honest, especially given that Vertonghen and Moussa Dembélé are also injured out. And, you know, those are, again, two of their most experienced players. I think if they're going to have to be very reliant on Kane. They're going to need Eriksen to step up. He hasn't started the season especially well. They'll need a big contribution from Lucas Moura. So, it's funny. The more I think about this game, I don't really know what to expect. But perhaps the stage is set for Messi to take over.
And, of course, as I said, you're in Germany for Manchester City against Hoffenheim. It should be pretty regulation, I think. But Hoffenheim have a threat that you're keeping an eye on, I believe, in that you've written about today.
Yeah, I'm currently in Sinsheim, which is a strange place. It's basically it's like a motorway with some service stations and drive-throughs and a football ground where Hoffenheim play. But yeah, this evening Manchester City are playing there. And Hoffenheim's an interesting story, obviously, because they've kind of come from nowhere, funded by local software magnate. But now they're in the Champions League. And one thing that they've done very well is finding good, young, cheap Brazilian players, bringing them over for not much money, making them into, you know, established players in the European leagues and then selling them for a big profit. Luis Gustavo, who went on to Bayern Munich, Carlos Eduardo, who went on to Rubin Kazan, and most famously Roberto Firmino, who now plays for Liverpool, all of them, you know, generating big profits for the club. The next man, or the next part of that production line, is Joelinton, who will be playing up front for Hoffenheim tonight. He's an interesting guy because, again, he came from Sport Recife, you know, fairly unheralded, had to go on loan to Rapid Vienna for a few years to kind of learn European football, but he's now probably the first name on the team sheet and really embraces the kind of aggressive pressing style of Julian Nagelsmann. So I'm looking forward to seeing him play. I think he's going to give City a bit of a rough time. It's funny with City because they lost the first game at home to Lyon. Suddenly, all these other games have a bit of added extra pressure, and they're not going to breeze through the group as perhaps we thought they would. But maybe that's a good thing. I mean, that's what Pep Guardiola said in the press conference yesterday, is that he kind of wants City, like everyone at City, the club, the players, the fans, to take this competition as seriously as he does. And maybe the fact that they did screw up the first game and they now have to go, they now have what he called five finals left in the group stage, that might encourage them to like appreciate the competition, respect it, value being in it, value staying in it. And perhaps that might kind of create the kind of enthusiastic atmosphere that he's been begging people at City to to really conjure up for these games. So it's going to be an interesting one.
Thank you, Jack Pitbrook, in Germany with Manchester City. Back in Manchester is our Northern football correspondent, Mark Critchley, who's had quite the week, really, dealing with the fallout of a certain Portuguese man who's not having his way at the moment. So, Critch, do you think the Mourinho situation is likely to bleed into the Champions League?
I see absolutely no reason why not. It's like a contagion that's spreading, and it's not competition specific. It runs much deeper than that. You can tell that from the performance on Saturday. I thought, I personally wasn't at the Brighton defeat, but I'm reliably told that was much worse. But still, in terms of watching United firsthand, Saturday was the most inept, kind of listless display that I've seen from them under Mourinho. And I thought Luke Shaw was absolutely right afterwards to come out and call it horrendous. Mourinho himself has talked a lot about attitude recently, and it now feels as though the pool of players that you can trust to at least look like they're performing for him and trying to turn things around, that pool seems to be shrinking. On Saturday, it seems to me like you just had Young, of course, Marouane Fellaini's trusted lieutenant, Matic, and McTominay, a kid that, you know, owes everything to him. You know, there's players like Shaw who know they have something to prove and they're playing, you know, moderately well, but the rest just seem disillusioned, and it tallies with what we're hearing about dressing room unrest as well. The problems with Pogba and Martial have been there for all to see. Valencia and Sanchez, they were bombed out on Saturday. I think basically we're coming to a point now where a few good results do not solve the underlying issues. They simply kind of slow the news cycle down a little bit and give everyone a chance to breathe and allow the club to muddle on until the next defeat, which you have to say is just no position that Manchester United should be in.
And what do you make of these reports we've seen linking Conte and Zidane, and particularly the one I saw on the front of Corriere della Sport, which is the Beppe Marotta Conte element of that story?
Yeah, I think the thing to note on Conte is that, yes, he's on the market, and yes, people are suddenly starting to remember that, but he's still being paid by Chelsea to the tune of about £9 million a year, and he will be for the remainder of the season, so long as he does not take up another job. Now, you'd imagine that, given how hard he had to fight for that severance package, given how long it took to come to him, that any offer would have to be a substantial one, and it would also probably have to be long-term rather than as a stopgap. On United's side, I think you also have to consider, would they really want to follow up Mourinho with another manager who's just left Chelsea in quite acrimonious circumstances? On Marotta, it's an interesting one that's only just emerged over the weekend since his announcement. But he said that he intends to take a sabbatical rather than jump into another job. And I think we've seen other names like Paul Mitchell at Red Bull Leipzig linked with this director of football role that United are looking to appoint. So I think for now, other avenues are more likely. And then, yeah, Zidane, who is probably the most likeliest candidate in terms of a Mourinho replacement. He's someone who would command the respect of certain members in that dressing room, and he would steady things somewhat, I think, even if we're sceptical about just how good a manager he is. But I think really the bottom line is this: when has Ed Woodward moved to sack a manager in the past? With Moyes, it was immediately after the Champions League was out of reach. Van Gaal had a stay of execution up until the FA Cup final, but he'd effectively been sacked before his post-match press conference that day, and I think he would have gone even earlier had they not reached the final that year. So I think Woodward would be reluctant to change mid-season. I think he's reluctant to change mid-season, and I think history shows that to an extent. The caveat to all this is that Mourinho is a different animal to Moyes and Van Gaal, and he could make the situation impossibly toxic and almost force Woodward's hand. So it'll be results. Results will be the kicker, the momentum that brings a decision forward, if you like. So lose to Valencia tonight, struggle against Newcastle, then there's the international break, and then there's a trip to Chelsea right after it. And if those three games go poorly, you wonder then whether things have to come to a head.
Thank you, Critch. Miguel is next up. We're going to talk to him about Spurs-Barca, where he will be on Wednesday night. Migs, Barca rested Messi on Saturday. With this game in mind, what do you think that tells us about Spurs' improved standing in Europe among the sort of big clubs?
Well, Spurs have developed a huge amount of respect in Europe now, particularly Spain, where obviously Madrid have been looking at Pochettino and Kane so intently and would have greatly taken Pochettino in the summer. So that's something that in itself has framed opinions of Spurs. But it's interesting how these things flip around. I mean, 2 weeks ago, when they got beaten by Inter Milan and Messi had another masterclass of a night against PSV, I mean, you would have feared for Spurs at that point about what could happen at Wembley, because they're on such bad form, can win a game, and up against that. Whereas now, in the space of 2 weeks, it's completely shifted, because Spurs, they've at least got some of their rhythm back. They've picked up points again. They've showed their durability. And Barca, albeit with Messi in and out because games like this, have dropped so many points in the last 2 weeks. It could completely almost change the perception of their season. In saying that, it's what it always comes back to with Barca, and what is pretty much their defining element right now. If Messi's on it, then you can forget about everything else. And that's what's been responsible for their last few league titles. That's what is responsible for most of their victories now. And that is the major responsibility for Spurs, finding a way to kind of shuttle him out of the game or do something. But if he's on form, then they can almost forget about it. If he's not at his best, then this Barca side has vulnerabilities. And even if Spurs themselves aren't at their best, I think they still have an organisation. I mean, tactically, you could actually argue there's slightly more about Spurs and Pochettino than there is about Barca and Valverde. They don't have Messi.
And I know you're obviously focused on this game, but you're also at Chelsea-Liverpool on Saturday. I've been discussing that here with Liam and Luke. What do you expect from them in a kind of a tough trip for Liverpool to Naples, where Carlo Ancelotti's waiting? It sounds like the locals aren't particularly pleased with him.
Liverpool very much impressed me on Saturday against Chelsea, but for very different reasons. I mean, to be honest, even though they're kind of building up a siege towards the end of that game, I was expecting a defeat. I was surprised at Sturridge's late goal, and I thought it was one of the kind of almost one of those typical stories with Klopp at Liverpool, where they're so good to a certain point, but then ultimately they just can't take it through. And okay, they didn't win the game, but I think that draw and the manner of it and the meaning of it will be almost more important to Liverpool than say having won that game. You could just had it got out of a situation we would have seen before. So I think they're going to be very dangerous for everyone this season in that regard. And that you can pretty much tell that old slight fragility to the vulnerability, it might be being gradually eroded to the point it's not going to be an issue anymore. I think Napoli are the opposite. And I don't want to disparage Ancelotti too much, although I've always had issues with his league record. But I think he is a manager on the decline. I think you could... I suppose the major thing with him and Napoli is that Sarri had such a defined style imposed in that team, and it was applied so rigorously, whereas Ancelotti is so much more laissez-faire. And as with Bayern after Pep, it feels like Napoli are still... a lot of the players are still almost performing that style from muscle memory, but that's gradually fading away. So while Liverpool, I suppose, are gradually becoming a more resolute side, Napoli, I think, are gradually becoming a looser side. There still might be enough about them to trouble Liverpool, especially in Naples, which, you know, is always going to be an awkward Champions League venue in that regard, and an intimidating Champions League venue. But I think Liverpool will just have too much. Although again, a draw in this situation will be by no means a poor result.
And the last man to talk to has been at the Ryder Cup this weekend with me. It's Jonathan Liu, who's not going to Spurs versus Barcelona because he has an important five-a-side game. So, Johnny, tell us the situation here and what exactly is the prize on offer?
Okay, so basically, my team, which we're called Xmas Jazz and Flax and Waxen, we started playing in this five-a-side league 3 years ago. And since then, there's been like 6 or 7 seasons. And we started in Division 1, and then we got relegated to Division 2. And then we got relegated to Division 3. Then there was a little sort of plateauing period in Division 3. And then we got relegated to Division 4, where the bottom of all four divisions, where we have now resided for a couple of years. And this season is our chance to basically get promotion for the first time. We're about two-thirds of the way through the season. We do pretty well. We feel like we've got a measure of most of the teams. And this is one of those sort of must-win games against a team whose name escapes me, actually. But it's very, very big. And the prize is an escape from eternal ignominy, which I think is, I think we can all agree, is something that that all men and women strive for most of their lives.
Thank you to Johnny. Thank you to all the guys out and about. They have thankfully contributed to this podcast to get a nice Champions League phone in for the first time. If you like it, let us know. If you don't like it, don't tell us, because the boys get sad when they hear criticism. But until then, do we have any further thoughts you would like to share on the weekend's Premier League action, Luke or Liam?
Oof, put me on the spot there.
Crystal Palace Bournemouth. I know you were all watching that, 2-1.
Wasn't as good as Burnley Cardiff. Burnley Cardiff. It's absolutely super.
Ball in play for 42 minutes.
I can't believe that. It's incredible.
I can't believe Neil Warnock is still a Premier League manager.
The thing is, they've not been playing like that badly. Like, I know, obviously, they've made a really bad start, but they were okay, and they like played well against Arsenal.
It's so old-fashioned the way they play, though.
It also feels like, even the way Warnock is acting, it just feels like he's treating this entire season as like a sort of media-friendly tour.
Yeah,
he knows that they can't stay up, so he's just being as nice to every journalist or every interviewer as he can be.
Doesn't look like it is almost like he's just going to enjoy it.
Yeah,
they don't look like a team that has a chance of staying up.
Big season out. Why not?
Yeah. Arsenal at the weekend.
Yeah, same old story. They didn't play that well and won. So they're picking up points. They're
That's
doing
better
okay.
than the other way around, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, well, obviously Arsenal supporters are like super neurotic, and there's been quite a lot of kind of, you know, angst over, you know, the fact that they're not playing very well, and they keep starting games like incredibly slowly. But Watford have made a really good start and have been playing very well, and, you know, probably did deserve something out of that match. But they just the problem with Watford's style of play, I think this was the first time Javi Gracia has actually had to change his starting 11, which is insane. And they pressed relentlessly and played really well. And then 75 minutes, they just died. Alex Iwobi comes on, runs down the right wing, sets up the goal, and then 2 minutes later, Arsenal score again. So it was quite a kind of clinical performance from Arsenal, I suppose.
How much do you feel like Arsenal have changed? Because they were always good at beating the teams they should beat, even under Wenger, weren't they?
Yeah, I think there's... you can notice the improvement. Like, I didn't even think at the beginning of the season, obviously the City game, you just scratch completely because they were never going to win that and never looked likely to win that match. But we were both at Chelsea, weren't we? And I thought for the Chelsea game, that was kind of really in the balance. And they responded to that defeat really, really well. Kept picking up points. And I think you can really start to see what Emery is doing with that team and what he's trying to achieve. And the problems he's got more at the moment is just trying to work out where to slot players.
Problem is, though, when you're not playing well and you're getting results, that if the results take a downturn, then people are very quick to jump on you.
Yeah.
But this is very Emery. This is kind of what you'd expect from Unai Emery, I think, based
sure
on this.
And I think it suits Arsenal to, after the last season and the whole Arsene Wenger pantomime of the last however many years, I think it suits them to kind of be flying under the radar a little bit at the moment. There's not too much fuss, you know, they're kind of just keeping their heads down, getting on with business. And I think the really interesting thing this week in Azerbaijan and also at Craven Cottage on the weekend will be to see how Bernd Leno does in goal, because he came on for Cech, who did his hammy just before half time and had a great, great second half, made like an absolutely superb save to deny Troy Deeney. And, you know, you can just see like how he kind of knits that defence together a little bit better than Cech. And he was spraying around passes and stuff. So, yeah, I think that's the big kind of talking point ahead of Azerbaijan, if there is one.
And we will be discussing Azerbaijan next Monday, the big game, Karabag versus Arsenal, the big game, Chelsea versus Videoton. Thank you, guys. Sorry, they're not called Videoton anymore, just Vidi. Thank you for
ending on that.
Thank you for all our phoning helpers, Miguel Delaney, Jack Pitbrook, Mark Critchley, and Johnny Liu, who we all wish the best of luck in his five-a-side conquests. On Wednesday night, I've been Ed Mallion. Thank you to Luke. Thank you to Liam. And thank you to Acast, our podcast providers. Until next time, thank you for joining us.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.